Please the court, Robert Lichty for appellant Carruthers. My number is 14652. As the court is aware, this appeal concerns the application of an amendment to the attorney's fee statute of the Wage Claim Act. And that was amended, the bill was introduced by Representative Judd, and he said there were two parts to the bill that he introduced. One part had to do with attorney's fees, the other part had to do with the amount of penalties. Previously it had been 50%, he had suggested 300%, the compromise was 125%. But there was no change to the language of the proposed change to the attorney's fee provision. It was originally it had been changed, as he said. There was a significant change in 2003 when there was a winner-take-all approach. When the statute was changed so that was the word shall in there, the prevailing party shall get his attorney's fees. And he said specifically to that amendment, he said that that did not work at all. And he gave an example. He said, if you're an employee and you don't get your wages paid, you go in and you want to get some relief, the attorney is going to advise you that you may have to pay for your employer's attorney's fees. And he said, Representative Judd said, it's not fair, because the employee is going to say, well, I can't pursue this then because I simply can't afford, given what little money I have, I can't afford my employer's attorney's fees. And he specifically counterposed that against the typical employer, a company. He said employers typically have attorneys that they retain, and so there's really, it's not something new to them, it's part of their normal business. So he was he indicated that the new language in the act, the new language took care of that problem in the difference in power between the employee and the employer. So I believe what he was saying is that the language in the act, because it was modeled on the language in the federal attorney's fee provisions, and the federal rule is very clear, if the plaintiff prevails, the plaintiff gets attorney's fees upon the theory that the plaintiff is that the attorney is acting as a private attorney general, or actually the plaintiff is acting as a private attorney general, to ensure that certain policies of the federal government are upheld. Likewise, in this case, it's a policy of the state government that that employers pay their employees whatever they earned when they leave employment with the employer. So if that's not done, you need a private attorney general to enforce that. As Representative Judge said during the introduction of the bill, there was a question by another representative regarding, well, why don't we have the Department of Labor do this? He said, we just don't have the money to have the Department of Labor go out and enforce this provision. We'd rather have it. He didn't say private attorney general, but it was very clear that he was intimating that this act is designed to pay for private attorney generals to enforce this state policy.
Mr. Lichty, what are we to make of the fact, though, that when Representative Judd introduced the bill, it contained a new provision that expressly made awards to employers available only if the claim was frivolous? And then he withdrew that in the subsequent version of the bill in favor of language that seems to treat employers and employees alike.
But he was stating in his example, he was saying that they're not alike. And I believe, although I didn't find any discussion of this, I believe that they were simply adopting the language that is used by the federal courts in the Christiansburg case. That language is virtually identical in the operative parts. That is, the court may award attorney's fees to the prevailing party. And the rule now is, if you're a plaintiff and you're a prevailing party, you get your fees unless there's some unusual circumstances. If you're a defendant in a prevailing party, you don't get your fees unless it was frivolous or unreasonable litigation brought against the defendant.
I review the legislative history, though. When Representative Judd proposed this language saying that an employer could only receive attorney fees if the employee's claim was frivolous, he said he needed to have further discussions with the employer's representatives, came back and deleted this provision and said that this was all he could get an agreement on. I mean, doesn't that indicate a directly contrary intent to require a showing of frivolousness?
No, it doesn't. And the reason why is because you have the Colorado courts are going to follow, in similar litigation, Colorado courts are going to follow their federal counterparts, number one.
Well, what? There's no federal counterpart to this law. Title VII, this is not a Title VII counterpart.
No, you're right. But there is a federal counterpart for labor attorney's fee shifting provisions, and that's what this is. In other words, this is a labor where you have employer-employee, so you have a difference in power between the two. And they wanted to, and they said that, Representative Judd said that the old version didn't work. Because what happened was employees, if they lost, they would have to pay the employer's attorney's fees. What you're intimating is that under the new language, if you change the shall to may, you're going to have the exact, you have the exact same problem. You haven't solved the problem.
You know, before it was mandatory and now it's discretionary. That's a different standard.
But then how is the discretion measured, which is the second issue?
Well,
in this case, Judge Sands had specifically said, he said, I'm going to grant the fees because I think that the new statute has some concern for equal protection, that is both parties, whether they be plaintiffs or whether they be employer or employee, that one is going to be liable. They both should be liable for attorney's fees. So he was applying the exact same rule. He said that if the employee loses, the employee is liable to attorney's fees.
And that's not how I read the order. He said he was exercising his discretion to.
Yeah, I know. But how? How can you judge how he exercised his discretion? You have no way to judge that because he didn't say what he was doing. He simply announced his conclusion. I'm exercising my discretion. He said, because I think that this act applies equally to both sides. That's what he said.
Because you had made the claim that it didn't.
Yes. And he said, no, I think it does. It applies equally to both sides. So I'm exercising my discretion. I'm simply saying, yeah, I'm going to grant attorney's fees. How can we possibly challenge that on appeal?
Well,
we don't have a standard against which to measure that.
I didn't read anything in your brief challenging that on appeal. I read a challenge to the amount of the fees and to the court's legal finding that there's not a standard of frivolousness applicable here,
but no
challenge to the actual exercise of discretion to award the fees.
But we said in the appeal, we said there is no way to, we don't know how he exercised his discretion. And there's a specific section in our brief saying that this court can't measure how he exercised his discretion. We just don't know how he did it. We don't know what he did. He just said, well, I feel like I'm going to give attorney's fees. And then he said, you better appeal this because it's really not clear to me, and I want one side or the other to appeal it so we have clearer law.
Let's take a step back. The statute's language is exactly the same with respect to employers and employees, but you want us to impose an extra textual requirement on employers, but not employees.
Yes.
Why? I mean, what's ambiguous about why? How can we take identical language in the statute and interpret it differently? I mean, there's a canon of construction that says if you use identical language in a statute, it's interpreted identically. How do we get around that?
It's really no different than the Christiansburg holding. It's no different at all because there you have identical language applied to both. Well, it's prevailing party.
Yeah, right.
So it's neutral. And here we just happen to be split out, but it's basically it's functionally the same thing. And in the Christiansburg case, there's a different standard for plaintiffs versus defendants.
I understand that, but we're dealing with state law here.
No, I understand that.
Okay.
Yes, I understand.
We have to look at the statute, and we can only do what you want us to do. First of all, if we determine the statute's ambiguous.
Right.
Okay. What I'm asking about here is, given that the express language of the statute treats both employers and employees alike, What's the ambiguity?
It's not the ambiguity. It's what was the intent of the legislature when it passed this, knowing that the word may can either be under that the case we cited, the Wolt case, may can either be mandatory or directory. May is not an unambiguous word.
Well, it either means discretionary or it means something even more. It could mean shall, for example,
yeah.
But that wouldn't help your client either.
No, it can't
mean anything less than discretionary, can it?
All I'm saying is that it is not clear. So then you have to go to the legislative history, and what we have is the introduction by a representative judge saying this is the problem that we're trying to solve. We amended the statute. We made a change. We changed it from shall in 2003 to may in 2007. So if the change is going to have some effect, it has to have an effect. And the effect I'm suggesting is the effect that was previously recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court in a correspondingly in a similar type attorney's fee shifting provision.
Mr. Lichty, I understand that the legislative declaration refers to federal law, but it doesn't refer to the Christenberg case. It refers to the Newman case. And my understanding of the Newman case is there they did not limit the award of attorney's fees to the extent defenses were advanced for purposes of delay or for a frivolous reason.
Okay.
And so I would like you to expound on that.
Well, that would blend in with what I'm talking about now. In other words, the legislature is recognizing a different standard for prevailing plaintiffs and prevailing defendants.
Is so in Newman?
I unfortunately I was not able to find that part of the legislative history, and so I didn't read the Newman case. But it would surprise me if Newman wasn't that way, because the federal law is just universal in how it's applied when it comes to fee shifting arrangements. I see if there's no other questions, I want to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Amy Hartman, Hartman Employment Law Practice, on behalf of the defendant appellees, Carrier Access Corporation and Turin, ID number 32502. Your Honors, the standard of review on appeal in determining whether the trial court used the appropriate legal standard for awarding fees under the Colorado Wage Act is de novo. If the Court of Appeals agrees with the defendant appellee that the trial court used the appropriate legal standard, then the amount of the fees awarded by the court, here an initial award of two-thirds of the amount that was requested, or $94,000, was later reduced to $34,000. That's less than one-quarter of the fees that we applied for, whether that was an abuse of discretion by the trial court. And further, whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in awarding certain costs to the defendant. We submit that the trial court applied the appropriate legal standard for an award of attorney's fees under the Colorado Wage Act, and that the court did not abuse its discretion in awarding and subsequently reducing those fees to $34,000. We also submit that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in awarding costs and did not award costs that were contrary to the Colorado statute. We moved for attorney's fees under both the Colorado Wage Act and under Section 1317-101, which is the frivolous, groundless, and vexation statute that allows for an award of attorney's fees. Both claims for attorney's fees were fully briefed and argued before the trial court.
The trial court crossed out the language in the proposed order that would have found that the claims were frivolous. So we can presume, can we, that the court did not find they were frivolous?
Yes. I think that we can presume that the court did not find that they were frivolous under the frivolous and vexatious standard, and that the court was focusing on the standard of review under the Colorado Wage Act. And that was certainly the focus of argument when we had oral argument before Judge Sandstead. But I would submit that the standard, as the court just pointed out, under the Colorado Wage Act is not ambiguous. The language that is in Section 84110 is quite clear. It is quite clearly a shift from the 2000 and from the earlier statute. It is actually slightly more onerous on the employer, and I think that was intentional. If you look at the language of 84110, the court may only award attorney's fees to an employer where the amount in controversy is over $7,500 or the amount of the small claims court cap, which I believe right now is $10,000. So I think in adding that little shift between when it's appropriate to award fees for a prevailing plaintiff employee versus employer, I think the legislature was actually addressing the issue that Mr. Lichty and other employees might have concern with, which is also something that was addressed by Judge Sandstead, that this is not, I think he used the phrase that the statute was for, and I don't mean to be facetious, I think it was ditch diggers or lower level employees who were trying to get their wages, and that in adding the language about the $10,000 limitation, I think the legislature was saying that we're talking about awarding attorney's fees to employees in sort of larger type wage claims when there's more at stake. And it is a wake-up call to the employees that if you're going to bring this type of claim, you need to be mindful that you have a good faith basis for bringing the claim and that you may be subject to attorney's fees if the employer prevails. So there is actually a very specific standard set forth in the statute, and which Judge Sandstead, in his ruling from the bench and in the ruling, the actual minute order, he was clear that we were the prevailing party, and that the amount in question was reached, and that it would be a deterrent. And there were several other points to the ruling. The only thing that was crossed out was the frivolous part. But I think that all of those standards that are set forth in the statute were met, and there's no ambiguity. So we don't need to go to the legislative history, as the plaintiff appellant suggests in this case, because the statute is clear on its face.
What do we do, though, about the statement of the legislative declaration of purpose? I mean, that's part of the bill. It's part of the law. It's enacted just as the rest of the law is, and it says that the statute should be construed as the federal courts have construed attorney fee provisions applicable to Title VII claims. And there is this Christiansburg case. So what are we to do with that?
I think that the standard in Title VII is slightly different than for a wage provision. And I do think that they were talking about the shift, and that the court has to certainly be mindful of the impact of imposing attorney's fees for a prevailing employer, but that does not equate to reading into the statute a requirement of frivolousness. In fact, the senator said that under the new statutory language, there would have to be a showing of frivolous or at the discretion of the judge. That's clearly in the legislative history. And so it was two separate things, frivolous or at the discretion of the judge. So those are two separate standards. And I would submit that the argument that you're going to impose a frivolousness standard of all words, of all levels of sort of requirements to impose where they're not in the statute, that particular phraseology and requiring a court to have a standing of frivolousness, no other courts that were addressing the mandatory provision of the language in Colorado ever used that terminology. And in terms of frivolousness, we have a separate statute that one moves for attorney's fees in Colorado, the 1317 statute, which is frivolous vexatiousness. And we argued both, but I would submit that I don't believe that the legislature was trying to have two different attorney's fees provisions that were of the same standard. So while it may be that that the courts should use some language in terms of deterrence, in terms of that it was discretionary, I don't think that the standard that the plaintiff is asking to be imposed here is warranted. And it's not anywhere really in the legislative history or in the case law interpreting this particular statute.
Let's talk about the amount. The court's orders regarding the amount, both the first order awarding 67.5% and the subsequent order reducing that to, I think, 30%, are completely conclusory. And there's no indication at all as to how the court arrived at that figure. And don't we have to have some sort of indication so that we can determine whether the court did abuse its discretion?
Actually, the court in oral argument with regard to the amount that it was awarding, the 94,000, the original amount, actually did some calculation from the bench and stated that it was two-thirds of the amount that we were requesting. There were three different causes of action that were brought by the plaintiff. There was a breach of contract, there was the Wage Act claim, and there was a claim for unjust enrichment. And so there is language from the bench talking about that he thought that the two-thirds amount was the right amount, that we had argued under the Maurer case that they didn't have to, that because the claims were interrelated, there didn't have to be a strict finding of reducing it by either a third or two-thirds. In fact, we argued that the judge could have awarded the full amount of the fees, even though they weren't all expended on the one wage claim. And the judge, there was some back and forth on that during the hearing, and the judge listened to that, took it under advisement, and said, I'm going to award two-thirds. I think that's an appropriate amount, and that certainly would be supported by Maurer and some of the other cases. So I don't think it was completely pulled out of thin air. Could he have been a little bit more clearer from the bench? Sure. But I think that there was a reasonable basis for making that award. We submitted an affidavit as to the amount of the fees, which is appropriate under the Colorado statutes in terms of determining how much fees to award. Now, with respect to the subsequent reduction to $34,000, I agree. There really isn't a finding. It was a one-page finding by the judge in response to the plaintiff's motion for reconsideration. It appears that he reduced his original amount by two-thirds, and was really kind of getting to the nub of what he thought the attorney's fees were expended with respect to only the wage claim. But again, I don't think, unless we find that the amount of fees that he did award, the $34,000, is unreasonable, then this court really has no basis for overturning it, because the standard really on an abuse of discretion is whether or not the attorney's fees were reasonable. And I believe there's ample case law that if you have an amount of fees that were expended of over $104,000, that reducing it down to $34,000 is certainly reasonable.
Say per se reasonable without any justification.
Well, I mean, I think that if you look, if one determines that the award of the $94,000 was reasonable based on what the judge said during the argument, then I would submit that reducing that further down from what was reasonable at 94 is certainly reasonable at 34, and that you don't need any further showing.
Ms. Hartman, the parties were disputing whether or not there was a motion to reconsider the attorney fee award. Can you point to where in the record the motion to reconsider?
The motion for reconsideration was part of the plaintiff's motion for a stay of the award of attorney's fees, and I should be able to find that citation. I'm not sure if we're still disputing that, because it was clear that it was a motion for reconsideration and it was fully briefed. But while I'm looking for that, we can perhaps move on to the, if there are no other questions, to the award of costs.
I have a question about the attorney fee.
Okay.
Question related to a question Judge Jones had asked your opposing counsel. How do we determine whether or not the court abused its discretion in awarding any fees here? What are the factors we determine or can use to determine whether or not any fees should have been granted at the discretion of the trial court?
It's a very good question. I think that if you look at the case law around the previous statute, which of course was mandatory, a lot of the dicta in the cases that were decided under that statute was that it was to prevent frivolous litigation, to act as a deterrent, to and things of those nature. So I think that would be where we would look in terms of whether or not the court was applying the appropriate legal standard. But because it's a permissive statute that that does not have ample sort of case law developed, we don't really have too much guidance in terms of what would be the appropriate standard. Some courts have said whether or not the case lacked merit. Obviously, as the judge found in his ruling, the case lacked merit because he awarded a directed verdict. It would act as a deterrent, and he specifically found that both in his ruling from the bench and also in the court order itself.
So do you think the factors we should consider lack?
Yes.
Any other factors consider?
Not that I can think of at this time.
Or that a trial court should consider, not that.
I think the totality of the circumstances. I think whether or not the another thing that the court looked at was whether or not the plaintiff was on notice or should have been on notice that an award of attorney's fees might come into play. And that was certainly something that we raised repeatedly throughout the litigation, that it was our intent that if we prevail that we would move for attorney's fees. So I think that's certainly a factor as to that the court should consider is whether the party was aware of the possibility of attorney's fees, the deterrent factor, and the lack of merit. And I'm not finding that citation.
That's fine.
If there are no other questions, if there are any questions on the award of court costs, I can address those or I can sit down. All right, thank you.
Counsel.
I would just point out that if the law that Judge Sands said apparently was following, that if that is upheld by this court, then I'm going to have to advise my clients, I'm sorry, you just can't proceed under these types of cases when your damages are going to be over $7,500. Because we have, I would tell my clients, I said, there's no way I know if there's going to be attorney's fees against you or not. And they could be considerable. Consider this case. My fees were $44,000. Their fees were $140,000. I can't control the defendant's fees, and typically there's going to be a big difference.
What about this distinction the statute draws, though, between claims of under $7,500 and those over? I mean, a claim under $7,500 is subject to an award of fees if it's frivolous under the frivolous and groundless statute,
right?
Wouldn't you agree?
Right.
So if an award of fees can be made on a claim that's over $7,500 only if it's frivolous, the distinction is completely meaningless.
Well, it's not exactly, because the frivolous and groundless statute is a little bit different. It's frivolous, groundless. It's actually frivolous, groundless, and vexatious.
It still includes frivolousness.
Right.
So it erases the distinction between claims over and under.
Not exactly. If you take a look at how the Supreme Court characterized, and this is back in 1978 when it did Christiansburg, it was frivolous with unreasonable, and I think it was without merit. So if you take that triumvirate versus the other triumvirate, there is a distinction. Now, is that a big distinction? No. Perhaps it'll take some other case further down the line to make that distinction clearer. But it is a distinction. And also, keep in mind that the legislature in 2007, they amended the statute. But if what Judge Sandstead did is allowed to stand, in effect, there is no amendment. Because I'm still going to have to advise my clients, I'm sorry, but you can't pursue this type of litigation if the damages are going to be above $7,500, because there's a substantial likelihood that you're going to get hit with attorney's fees if you lose. Now, I think you've got a good case, and I'll support you, but I just want you to understand that if you lose, I can't tell you what's going to happen.
Well, under the prior statute, you had to advise your clients, if you lose, you will pay.
Yeah.
You must pay.
And now,
but now it's, you may pay. There is a difference.
Well, maybe there is a difference. According to Judge Sandstead, he said, and you know, take a look carefully at that record, at his, we quoted in our brief. He said, I'm going to apply the statute equally. That's what he said. And that being the case, if my client loses, he gets fees assessed against him as if he were the winner. I see my time is up. If there's no other questions, thank you.
Counsel, thank you for your arguments, and we will issue an opinion in due course.